O My Lord. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Harishchandra had no son and was therefore extremely morose. Once, therefore, following the advice of Narada, he took shelter of Varuna and said to him, "My lord, I have no son. Would you kindly give me one?" So we'll read the next several verses. I'll just read the English. We have quite a ways to go. O King Pariksit, Harishchandra begged Varuna, "My lord, if a son is born to me, with that son I shall perform a sacrifice for your satisfaction." When Harishchandra said this, Varuna replied, "Let it be so." Because of Varuna's benediction, Harishchandra begot a son named Rohita. Thereafter, when the child was born, Varuna approached Harishchandra and said, "Now you have a son. With this son you can offer me a sacrifice." In answer to this, Harishchandra said, "After 10 days have passed since an animal's birth, the animal becomes fit to be sacrificed." After 10 days, Varuna came again and said to Harishchandra, "Now you can perform the sacrifice." Harishchandra replied, "When an animal grows teeth, then it becomes pure enough to be sacrificed." When the teeth grew, Varuna came and said to Harishchandra, "Now the animal has grown teeth, and you can perform that sacrifice." Harishchandra replied, "When all its teeth have fallen out, then it will be fit for sacrifice." Kind of sounds like he's giving the runaround here, doesn't it? When the teeth had fallen out, Varuna returned and said to Harishchandra, "Now the animal's teeth have fallen out, and you can perform the sacrifice." But Harishchandra replied, "When the animal's teeth grow in again, and then he'll be pure enough to be sacrificed." When the teeth grew in again, Varuna came and said to Harishchandra, "Now you can perform the sacrifice." But Harishchandra then said, "O king, when the sacrificial animal becomes a Kshatriya and is able to shield himself to fight with the enemy, then he will be purified." Harishchandra was certainly very attached to his son. Because of this affection, he asked the demigod Varuna to wait. Thus Varuna waited and waited for the time to come. Rohita could understand that his father intended to offer him as the animal for sacrifice. Therefore, just to save himself from death, he equipped himself with bow and arrows and went to the forest. When Rohita heard that his father had been attacked by dropsy due to Varuna, and that his abdomen had grown very large, he wanted to return to the capital, but King Indra forbade him to do so. King Indra advised Rohita to travel to different pilgrimage sites and holy places, for such activities are pious indeed. Following this instruction, Rohita went to the forest for 1 year. In this way, at the end of the second, third, fourth, and fifth years, when Rohita wanted to return to his capital, the king of heaven, Indra, approached him as an old Brahmin and forbade him to return, repeating the same words as in the previous year. And text 20. Thereafter, in the sixth year, after wandering in the forest, Rohita returned to the capital of his father. He purchased from Ajigartha his second son, named Sunapseha. Then he offered Sunapseha to his father, Harishchandra, to be used as the sacrificial animal, and offered Harishchandra his respectful obeisances. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. It appears that in those days a man could be purchased for any purpose. Harishchandra was in need of a person to sacrifice as the animal in the Jagya, and thus fulfill his purpose, his promise to Varuna. And a man was purchased from another man for this purpose. Millions of years ago, animal sacrifice and slave trade both existed. Indeed, they have existed since time immemorial. Om Gyanatimrandasya Gyananjana Salakaya Chakshunvitamina Tasmashi Garve Namaha Panchakopatribhischa Kripasindhivivacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavi Namo Namaha. Hare Krishna. So this seventh chapter of the ninth canto is somewhat a difficult chapter to understand. There's actually only two purports in this entire chapter, the one that we heard yesterday and this very short one today. So we're left somewhat to just to hear this and understand these chronologies and genealogies and understand that these are stories of great personalities that lived millions of years ago. And, we gather what we can without a lot of guidance from the past acharyas in terms of purports to these verses. Here we are hearing more of the history of the descendants of Vaivashvatu Manu I don't know if you've all found it or not, but in the back of the ninth canto, there's several genealogical tables and charts. I found it was very helpful trying to understand all of these stories of who was the son of who and this dynasty and that dynasty. So basically, the ninth canto is describing this dynasty of Vaiushvatu Manu. Of course, Vaiushvatu Manu is the current Manvantar, the current Manu in charge of creation and population of this material world. Not creation so much, but in terms of managing. And they're the general overseers, administrators of the universe. And one of their functions, of course, is to populate the universe with people, with human beings. So therefore, we have, you know, so many generations of coming of these Prajapatis, etc. So each, there were 10 sons of Vaiushvatu Manu. We've already heard of some of the dynasties of a couple of the sons. First we had Nabhaga, and Ambarish was in his line, so there was, of course, the long story of Ambarish Maharaj that we read about earlier in this canto. Then another son was Saryati, and we had the story of Chayavana Muni and his marriage. That was also described. And now we're in the line of Ikshvaku. Ikshvaku was one of the sons of Vaiushvatu Manu. Ikshvaku is also mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita as the son of Vibhishana, right? So this connection is there. Now, several generations down from Ikshvaku, we come to Mandata. And now in this chapter, we're talking about some of the descendants of this Mandata, who is a descendant of Ikshvaku, son of Vaiushvatu Manu. All with me? Okay, so now about then with Mandata, we had some of the stories. Like he had 3 sons and 50 daughters, and the 50 daughters were married to Shobari Muni, and we had the fall down of Shobari Muni described in that. Now we go about 7 generations more past Mandata, and we come to Harishchandra. This is 6 or 7 generations later. So this brings us up to where we are currently. So we have this rather unusual story of Harishchandra wanting a son, not being able to have one. He was advised by Narada Muni, so we figure this must have some greater spiritual purpose. Whenever Narada Muni is involved, we know that there's some, usually some deeper purpose, even if it's not seen on the surface. At any rate, he advises Harishchandra to go to Varuna and ask for a son. Varuna grants him the son, but there's a real heavy catch here. He's supposed to offer this son back to Varuna as a sacrifice. Actually, a human sacrifice is what's being described. They talk about it in terms of an animal sacrifice, but they're really talking about the son himself. So Harishchandra, naturally, as most fathers would be, was not too very pleased with this, and he becomes more attached to his very nice son, Rohit. He keeps putting Varuna off, giving him so many reasons why to wait and to wait. And then finally, when I guess there's no way of avoiding any longer, Rohit makes this arrangement of purchases this other person, Sunasepa, and he becomes the object of the sacrifice. So these things, of course, are very foreign to us, somewhat difficult to understand. It's interesting, this purport, that Srila Prabhupada simply mentions that millions of years ago, animal sacrifice and slave trade existed. And he doesn't give any evaluation. He doesn't say this is good, this is bad, this is positive, this is demoniac, this is righteous. He just says it existed, you know, since time immemorial. It's been there, apparently, in human society for many, many years. Now, as we'll see in the upcoming verses, great personalities like Vishwamitra Muni, Vishishta, and, you know, were all involved in the sacrifice. So it seemed to have the blessings of great sages and saintly personalities. Of course, we also heard yesterday about this quarrel between Vishishta and Vishwamitra, where they ended up cursing each other, and one became a bird, one became a duck. Now, when we were reading a couple months ago earlier in the story of was it Satyavrata, the son of Satyavrata, who was supposed to I think it was one of the sons of Satyavrata who was guarding the cows, and the tiger attacked, and by mistake he killed the cow when he was really trying to protect the cow because it was very dark at night, and he was cursed, I think, by Vashishta at that time. And Srila Prabhupada quotes in the purport, and he quotes Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, that this showed a lack of intelligence on the part of Vashishta Muni. So we should never criticize ourselves, these great personalities like Vasishtha and Vishwamitra. But if the Acharyas say something like this, then we can repeat. As it was being described yesterday, these personalities are not necessarily on the level of infallible pure devotees. We see a lot of what appears to be karmakanda and different religious Vedic principles, sacrifices, so many of these things. Of course, in former ages, sacrifice was a process of self-realization. So it can't really be condemned because it was directly according to religious principles. But it's very hard for us to understand these things today because things are so different. And in fact, one of the injunctions in Kali Yuga is that animal sacrifice is prohibited. So even the types of things that may have been going on in the past are completely prohibited in this age. Why? Because no one is qualified. No one is qualified to do these kind of sacrifices. In former ages, if an animal was sacrificed in the fire, they emerged out of the fire with a new body, from what Srila Prabhupada has told us. So in other words, there was no real harm to the animal. In fact, the animal was actually benefited. Now, in later times, especially in Kali Yuga, this animal sacrifice just became an excuse for meat eating. And so basically, slaughterhouses are developed in the name of animal sacrifice, and it became very, very rampant. So therefore, the Vedic injunction of Kali Yuga is no animal sacrifices, because it is completely misused. And I think we could see that for some of these other practices. They cannot be done in Kali Yuga because our whole society, government, religious leaders, etc., have all become corrupt. I was thinking about this verse in this chapter in general, and trying with my own limited intelligence to understand this, put this in some perspective of how we can understand these rather different stories that we hear sometimes in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And I was thinking that part of our problem is that we have a very, very different perspective, particularly our Western mentality. In the West, we have become acculturated and conditioned and learned from early ages to think of the world in certain ways, think of society in certain ways, which is very different than the Vedic perspective. And I think it's not just a question of Eastern versus Western. Sometimes that's an oversimplification we hear, because any of you who have been to India or you're from India, you can understand that India is becoming very much like the West in many ways now. So that distinction, is not so clear. But there certainly is a distinction between the Vedic society and Vedic culture, this original Vedic culture, and how things were understood. So I thought of there's probably many, many ways and perspectives of looking at this, but just for sake of some discussion, I thought of three ways or three perspectives where the Vedic understanding of life is very different than our more modern or Western conception. And those were, first of all, the understanding of the nature of the soul. Secondly, our sense of duty or purpose in life. And thirdly, our sense of what is appropriate social organization. So I think that in these stories and in this very limited translation purport that we have, these themes are there. And because of these different conceptions, I think makes it more challenging to fully understand, the Srimad Bhagavatam. So first of all, looking at the nature of the soul. We, of course, understand that the soul is eternal, that the soul is traveling in this body, and this body, of course, because of one's activities, one's karma, goes to the appropriate body in the next lifetime. And, of course, this is described right from the very beginning. This is practically the first lesson of the Bhagavad Gita, Dehi no spinyata, dehi kumram yovanam jara. As the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body and death. The a sober person, they changed these these translations. I'm thinking of like 1973, the translation. A sober person is not bewildered by such a change. But anyway, this was pretty close, the same. Interesting, a sober person is not bewildered by such a change. Now, of course, in Kali Yuga, none of us are very sober people. So we tend to become bewildered by death. We become bewildered by the change of the body. And due to that bewilderment, it's a couple things. First of all, we don't understand that the soul is immortal, that the soul is eternal. And therefore, we tend to look at everything within this current lifetime as the all in all. And we also become bewildered because we don't understand how our activities and behavior in this lifetime are actually creating the blueprint, creating the plan, the model for what our next life will be and what our next birth will be. So because of this lack of understanding, people tend to have a very short perspective. They have a very, very small or very limited time frame by which they view their life, others' lives, and what is going on in the world. So the fact that someone, if we say, for instance, if somebody performs some sacrifice that would actually diminish their own life, and we have many examples of that in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Who was it who gave up, was it Didichi who gave up his bones for sacrifice, you know, with the war between the demigods and the demons, you know, and, you know, how could someone do such a thing? You know, to our, you know, to most of our thinking, that would be impossible that one would, the way the story goes, basically they just ask him. They said, go to Didichi and ask him if he'll sacrifice his body so that we can, from his bones, make the thunderbolt which defeat the demons. And he says, okay, yeah, I'll do that. You know, so how is it? Why could someone do such a thing? Well, because they had this understanding. Really, they really realized they were not their body. You know, this body is temporary to live for some time. I might as well give it up for some good purpose, for some higher purpose. People could understand that, and they realized that they would benefit. They would realize that they would gain eternal benefit from such a thing, and that they would have a better lifetime, or they'd become liberated, or perhaps they go back to Godhead even, you know, through their sacrifice. So with this kind of understanding, you know, things look quite different. So the more that our perspective becomes very, very limited to this one lifetime, then that affects everything we do and that affects how we think. Therefore, people become overly attached to their lives, to their bodies, and they will do practically anything to maintain their lives and their positions because they consider this is all in all. And therefore, a person will be capable of any activity, any sinful activity, harming others, doing whatever one pleases, because after all, this is all I have. You know, you only go around once, you know, go for all the gusto and all of that, you know. In fact, our whole society, the economic fabric, the advertising, wants us to think this way. You know, in other words, don't give up anything. Get as much pleasure and sense gratification as you possibly can in this lifetime. In fact, not only do you need to do it because you only have this one lifetime, but it's your right. It's your right. It's your prerogative. It's what you should be doing. And if you are not completely enjoying your life to the fullest, there's probably something wrong with you. But that's all right. They have a product they can sell you to rectify that situation. At any rate, this brings about a great difference in perspective from what we see of the personalities in the Bhagavatam and how we might think in the West. The second idea was this idea of sense of duty or purpose in life. And here again we see this very much a contrast between an individualistic pursuit of self-interest and the understanding that one often needs to sacrifice or give of oneself for the greater good of society, for one's dharma, religious practice, and ultimately for the benefit and pleasure of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Of course, that's the highest understanding of the devotee, that one sacrifices one's own immediate self-interest for that greater interest of God or Krishna. Sometimes sociologists and others look at individualistic versus collectivist societies. And of course, our Western culture in America is probably the epitome of an individualistic society. Everything is, again, based upon the individual. Our particular rights, our enjoyment, that things are very much centered upon personal fulfillment, personal happiness. This is pretty much the way that we think life should be, that this focus should be very, very much centered on the individual. Now, of course, more enlightened societies think, well, if I have a right to the greatest happiness, then everybody else does too, so we should work for everybody's collective enjoyment and happiness. That's maybe a little more advanced than just selfishly looking out for my own, but it's missing very, very fundamental principles of religion. And so, of course, in other societies, there's more emphasis on the family, the town, the city, the village, the country, a greater interest other than one's own. But even this is missing the point. I mean, our epitome of collectivist societies would be, you know, communism in its purest form. Very much collectivist, very much the idea of, you know, sacrifice the individual for the greater good of the social order, of the society, the working class, whatever it may be. But we also see that these societies are often some of the most atheistic that we have seen. So, again, the point is missed. Whether one is working for oneself only, or whether one is working for my community, or for my country, or my class, all of these things simply lead one more and more into ignorance, not understanding the real purpose of life, and will not solve the problems of life. Whether you're a capitalist or you're a communist, you're going to experience birth, death, disease, and old age. And there's going to be individual suffering and collective suffering. There's going to be warfare, there's going to be natural disasters. All of these things are going to occur regardless of what political party we put in power and what ism that we are subscribing to at the moment. So the only real purpose, the only of human life, as we're told again and again in the Srimad Bhagavatam, is to formulate our life in such a way that our purpose is to serve the personality of Godhead in devotional service. And that means that there will be some sacrifice for the greater good, for our real, the real value of our service is not simply to sacrifice for the family or for the country, but to sacrifice for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the Bhagavad Gita 3.10, we hear Sahajavya Prajashishva Puruvacha Prajapati Anena Prashavidyadvam Esho Vost Vishtikamaduk. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods, along with sacrifices for Vishnu, and blessed them by saying, "Be thou happy by this yajna sacrifice, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation." So the key is sacrifice for Vishnu. In other words, that sacrifice, that religious principle, always needs to be centered on Vishnu or Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. If that understanding is there, then human society can be happy. The Bhagavad Gita is explaining how happiness, prosperity, religious principles, all these things that we want in an orderly society, we certainly want the welfare of the common good of the citizens. We want these things to come about, but it will only happen when there is proper sense of sacrifice. And that sacrifice must be to satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It's described that, of course, you know, we see so many examples of how all the purposes of many small ponds are served by the great reservoirs of water. If one waters the root of the tree, then all the leaves and branches are satisfied or nourished. We have so many examples like this that we hear in our scriptures that tell us that when Krishna is satisfied, the demigods are satisfied, everyone is satisfied. Naturally, the earth will produce. I was just reading the story of King Prithu, and because of the great atrocities of Vena, who had stopped sacrifice, Bhumi Mother Earth withheld. And then even when the Brahmins got rid of Vena, then rogues and thieves were taking over and there was lawlessness, so everyone was starving. So Prithu Maharaj, when he appeared, he immediately was very, very angry at Bhumi and was going to go with his bow and arrows and kill her and chastise her because she was not providing for the citizens, and he felt that great responsibility for them. And, of course, she explained to him that, well, I haven't been giving anything because there's irreligious principles and because there has not been proper sacrifice, there has not been the performance of religious duty. Then, of course, he rectifies everything, brings about proper religion, and everybody becomes satisfied in that way. So this brings us to the third point of social organization. In the Vedic society, we had a social organization of basically a monarchy. We had righteous religious kings and rulers. This is very foreign to our modern understanding, where we tend to promote democracy. And it's not unreasonable that this thinking has come about, because basically monarchy and the kings have failed. They failed the citizens. Because monarchies became corrupt over time, because they no longer really represented religious principles, they no longer took care of their citizens, then naturally people gave up all all hope or any kind of confidence in royal order. But we can understand that in the ancient times of the Srimad Bhagavatam and former yugas, very, very different situation. Of course, King Kritu, great example of how his first order of business was to take care of his citizens, to make sure that they were all fed, if nothing else. And in fact, I always thought one of the most remarkable examples, of course, we have as of Arjuna, right? When the Brahmin came to him, actually because their sons, his children, had died in childhood, he blamed Arjuna. You're the ruler. You shouldn't let anything like this happen. It's your fault. And Arjuna accepted that. You know, he accepted that responsibility. Yes, if I am a proper ruler, there shouldn't be things like untimely deaths of children in my kingdom. I am responsible. And he said, I will do whatever I have to do. I'll even give up my life if I can't get your children back. This was the kind of example we had of these saintly kings. The other thing that we no longer see is the saintly kings were also, they worked and served under the guidance of the Brahmins. So we even see an example of King Dasarath and Ramachandra. They would always be consulting with the spiritual master, a saintly personality, and they would very much follow their instructions and take those instructions. So, of course, this also broke down. As the Brahmin class also becomes degraded in Kali Yuga, there's no good spiritual advice. So we have a corrupt Kshatriya order, and we have a corrupt Brahminical order, where there is no real teaching, no real understanding of religious principles. So naturally, then, what happens is they all become rogues and thieves, as Prabhupada would often say, and people tend to reject these leaders. They reject religious leaders, they reject the political leaders, they reject the monarchs. Now, it's interesting that the Vedic system, although we see these dynasties where a kingdom is passed from one person to the other, there was also the sense of a meritocracy. One needed to be qualified. It wasn't just based upon class, that there was some way, I'm born as a Brahmin, I'm born as a Kshatriya, therefore I can exploit the people. No, there had to be qualification. So we understand even from Bhagavad Gita that one's varna is determined by guna and karma, by one's qualities and by one's work. So even if one is born as a Brahmin, if he does not have the qualities and is not doing the work of a Brahmin, he's not considered a Brahmin or a Kshatriya similarly. The person had to be qualified. Just in the case of Vena, Vena was born as the king, but he had no good qualities. Therefore, in fact, his qualities were so bad that ultimately the Brahmins had to kill him and remove him from that position because he was so unqualified. So qualification needs to be there. And of course, there was many, many more qualified personalities in the past yugas and past ages that we're reading about. Now, it's interesting that the sense, the strongest quality of a Kshatriya is to protect, right? This is described that the Vaishyas protect the cows, the Kshatriyas are supposed to protect the human society and protect the citizens. It's not to exploit them, it's not to rule over them, it's not to see how much fame and glory you can get, but it's to protect. And that's the quality that isn't there. Even recently, if we can read some of the romantic depictions of the time, but even a couple hundred years ago, say in English society, when you had nobles and gentry and like that, there was the sense that even that they had some power, they had some money, they had some education by their birth, but they felt an obligation to take care of those who worked for them. In other words, the people who worked on the land, there was a sense that there was sort of a paternal or protective sense. I'm sure it was exploited in many, many cases because we are talking about Kali Yuga, but there was a little bit of that remnant left. And that little remnant of that sense of protecting those that one was in charge of pretty much was destroyed by the Industrial Revolution. Once the Industrial Revolution came, that was finished. You know, then it's like, you know, put the people in the mines and in the mills and the textile factories and work them as much as possible. In fact, three-quarters of the workers, and just a little historical fact here, three-quarters of the workers in textile mills in England were children. Why? Because they could pay them less, and they could still run machines pretty well. So you had total exploitation, child labor. Actually, people's, in the first about 50 years of the Industrial Revolution, people flocked to the cities thinking they'd get these high wages, their standard of living actually went down. At least when they were on the farms, you know, there was food, unless there was a famine or something. You know, there was, you know, at least people could eat. It wasn't necessarily a great life, and I don't want to overly glorify it. But what we can see is what was considered to be progress with industrialism actually made a worse situation for the people, and their quality of life declined. What to speak of being crowded, going into crowded cities, polluted cities, unsafe working conditions, you know. So again, as we try to advance, so-called, with technology, often the result is quite the opposite. But the real thing that happened here was as Kali Yuga progressed, the sense of protection became less and less, to the point where governments are simply in power for their own advancement, for their own economic, political power, for their own fame, for their own glorification, and very little sense of really taking care of the people. Now, of course, in democracy, there's a lot of lip service to that, and politicians, you know, will promise anything as far as how they're going to give you everything that you want. Your full sense gratification, you know, can only be realized if you vote for me. But we see the results are always disappointing. You know, it's interesting to see, even in their last election, Obama was so popular, you know, and everyone was felt like, you know, this is like our savior when he was elected. And now everyone's dissatisfied. You know, and it's always going to be that way. It doesn't matter who it is. Whoever the leader, people are going to be dissatisfied. Because until the leaders of society can actually bring about Krishna consciousness, or at least religious principles, no one will be satisfied. The laws of nature are such that there will always be disturbance, there will always be suffering, there will always be difficulties, unless one actually offers sacrifice back through Krishna, Vishnu. And that is the only way that human society can actually progress and there can be happiness. You know, there's no other shortcut to that process by some political expediency or through some, you know, economic jugglery or whatever we may try to do to make our lives happy. And particularly, you know, we have great reliance upon science, technology. These things are going to make us happy, but yet we see the opposite is happening. People do not become happy. So I guess the lesson that we can take from all of this is to see that there's a very different perspective on the world, that when one has a perspective that one is the spirit soul, that one's duty and activities are very important in this lifetime, and particularly one's duty of sacrifice or surrender to God is really the purpose of life, and that is our real dharma. That is going to be what will make us happy and will give us everything that we need within this material world, as well as preparing us to leave this material world of suffering and enter into the spiritual world. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Questions, comments? Dharma? Yeah, that's a good example, because as we can see, it's very hard for us to understand these things because our society and culture is so different. You know, these things have such negative, negative implications for us. But when you think about it, what is our relationship with Krishna, the spiritual master? You know, we consider, you know, we are very much unpaid servants, aren't we? You know, but because the object of that servitude is pure, then we only benefit from it. So in the same way, if you're completely surrender or serving the Maharaj Yudhisthira, you know, how can you lose? You would actually be benefited because of him being such a great exalted devotee. You know. But you know, if you're a slave to some drunken plantation master in Mississippi, not the same thing. You know, nobody wants that. Ready? Completely different perspective. Many years ago, when I was in graduate school, I was I forget what I was doing some research report on something, and I found this study that someone had done. It was on life satisfaction, especially in older age, you know. Someone had actually gone and interviewed a bunch of I don't know exactly who they were. They went to somewhere like Varanasi or some holy city and. Bunch of like, you know, sadhus and, you know, these yogis and people like this. I don't know if they were Vaishnavs necessarily or not, but they were people who were, you know, just involved in their spiritual practice, and these were old men. And they said, according to every one of your normal criteria, your checklist of things to give life satisfaction, they said they were like at the bottom of the scale. They said there's nothing in their lives that should have made them happy, but yet their subjective experience, they were the most satisfied of anybody any other group that they had. So I mean, even in scientific research, you know, and this is confounding to people. You know, how is it that one who does not have material things can be, you know, spiritually happy and satisfied? It's like you're saying villages. Good point. Let me get Trivikram, then we'll come back. I just realized we don't have a microphone. I should be repeating the questions here. The comment was that many farmers in India are committing suicide, and part of it is because they buy tractors on loans, they can't pay the loan, they lose everything. Another thing I also heard that contributes to this is they're now introducing these hybrid seeds, and so they're actually kind of like forcing the farmers, or somehow they're buying up, you know, so they use hybrid seeds, and of course they're a little bit simple. Most people think that you save a certain amount of your seed out of your crop, you plant it, and then, you know, you use that. Well, you can't do that with hybrid seeds because they, you know, they don't remain true. There'll be some terrible, you know, so you have to only buy them from, you know, the company that's producing them, that's, you know, crossbreeding them and all of that. So that's another way. There's many ways like this that the farmers in India are being exploited by modern businesses, and as you said, this is a thing that's happening. Very, very unhappy. People even committing suicide. Yeah, I've read about that. Yeah. Okay. Let's take here the Dharmaraj and Gaudi. Okay. Go ahead. Yeah. It's very difficult, of course. You know, we're under a much difficult circumstance because we live in a greater society that has everything set up in a certain way. But Srila Prabhupada seemed to want it to happen. Srila Prabhupada, you know, so often talked about us setting example of simple living and high thinking, and he did want our farm communities to, you know, to attempt to show this to the world. So it's something that even though it has been difficult and we don't have a real good history, we should still strive for. We should still try to work for that. I think so, anyway. Very much.